When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Forget the frustration of picking commerce platforms when you switch your business to Shopify, the global commerce platform that supercharges your selling wherever you sell. With Shopify, you'll harness the same intuitive features, trusted apps, and powerful analytics used by the world's leading brands. Sign up today for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/tech, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/tech.
Standard issue for all women.
Hello and welcome to episode 299 of the Standard Issue Podzine. I'm Mickey Noonan, and you know, call me a cliche, I don't care, Hannah, because the lighter nights are already warming my cockles.
It is nice, isn't it? I meet a friend of mine on a Monday because her kids go swimming on a Monday. She does that thing where she hasn't really got enough time to go home, so she's been largely sitting in a car park, you know, listening to an audiobook or looking at Twitter or whatever for an hour. So I started going to meet her and we go for a walk. And the last time I saw her, I was like, guess what's going to happen next time we meet? It's going to be daylight. Not for all of it, but it's going to be daylight.
It's just so nice. The last dog walk of the day was done in daylight yesterday. Missy wasn't sure what to make of it. She was like, what? What's going on? Oh. Joyous.
I'm Hannah Dunleavy, and I'm excited to say Patricia Clarkson Day is nearly here.
Yeah, I'm really enjoying your new celebratory days of the year, Hannah. So yeah. Tell us a bit more about Patricia Clarkson Day, because it's not just Patricia Clarkson, is it?
It's not. It's also Brian Cox Day. Scottish Brian Cox, not astrophysicist Brian Cox, because he and Patricia Clarkson were doing something together. Would be a bit weird. I mean, I'd still watch it.
But... totally watch it.
Yeah, I'm going to see Long Day's Journey tonight on, well, it will be today when you're listening to this, which is very exciting.
That is so exciting. So your favourite Patricia Clarkson movie, is it The Station Agent?
It would be The Station Agent, yeah.
She's so good in that.
Yeah. She's really great in everything. Yeah. I shall report back.
Please do. Coming up, Jen chats to multidisciplinary artist Heather McColden about her genre-bending debut book, The Observable Universe, which is about losing both her parents to AIDS in the early 90s and about grief in the internet age.
And also might explain to me what a multidisciplinary artist is, hopefully.
It sounds very strict on various levels.
It does, doesn't it? I talked to Dr. Julia Shaw about how we should trust the experts, maybe not all the experts, and her new Radio 4 series, Experts on Trial.
I thought we'd just got back to the stage where we wanted experts, Hannah. Are you going to, like, blow all that out of the water?
Some of that out of the water. A couple of splashes out of the water.
Okay, I'll put my water wings on. But in the meantime, climb aboard the furry dragon, which is not only a euphemism up for grabs, but also because in this week's Rated or Dated, we're watching 1984's The Neverending Story. See you in the school attic, yeah? Sorry, what?
Yeah. It'll explain the weirdest WhatsApp message I ever sent anyone, which I sent you last night.
And it's one of my questions.
Okay. Hello, Hannah here. I'm joined by author and criminal psychologist Dr. Julia Shaw, whose new Radio 4 series, Experts on Trial, started this week. Julia, thank you for joining us.
Happy to be here.
So the last decade's been quite traumatic for the UK, what with Brexit and COVID and lockdown. But the one message that seems to have been coming through pretty clear is trust the experts. And here you come now in the new radio show telling me that maybe some of those experts aren't always as expert as they seem. So could we maybe start by you giving a little précis of what Experts on Trial is and how it came about?
So Experts on Trial is a passion project of mine that I created because as an expert witness, I'm frustrated by all the misconceptions that people hit me with. So I get asked, you know, aren't you just a hired gun? Is it really luxurious? There's a sort of assumption that it's really well paid. which is also typically not the case, especially in criminal trials. And just assumptions around, you know, science and that, well, can we really trust the science? And what if science changes? And I wanted to tackle lots of these issues head on in a series, which really demystifies the world of expert witnesses in various different academic fields.
You cover all sorts of things, hair, DNA. And the question appears to be throughout, how much is science and how much is opinion? And this is important for me to know because I might end up on a jury. So I might have the rest of somebody's life in my hands. How do you go about assessing what is fact and what is opinion?
Well, so hopefully the judge has decided before a jury hears an expert witness that that expert is in fact expert enough. And so that means that I have the relevant qualifications. So as an expert witness, especially if I haven't testified in a while or if I haven't testified in a certain place, the judge will pull me aside and ask me specific questions about my CV and then establish that I actually have the relevant qualifications for the thing I'm about to talk about. So that's part of it, that the judge is expected to sort of basically to do a quality control. Now, the problem with that is, of course, that judges also don't typically understand the science.
Yeah.
So the best a judge can do is look at your CV, look at you, establish whether or not you're credible, and then go, okay. And so from that point on, it's up to the experts to make sure that what they're presenting is actually based on evidence and not their opinion, but is based on an evidence-based sort of collection of things that we know and how it applies to the specific case at hand.
Yeah, it's interesting. A couple of months ago, one of my great uncles died and he had been a judge in Baltimore. But it wasn't until he died that I thought, I don't really know anything about any specific cases that he worked on. So I did a lot of Googling. So I've actually read a lot about a lot of the cases that he worked on over the years. And I just thought, hang on, this is insane the amount of things that you expected to know what the hell is going on. The number of different areas, not just the law and how quickly the law changes, so many other things. And I suppose it really drove home to me, because it was somebody I actually knew, how fallible they are.
How fallible they are as judges, but that's why you bring in the experts, right? Mm. Because it's even worse. So as much as I do in the series talk about how experts can also be biased and how we can try and understand when experts are being biased, like what kind of language are biased experts using? Because there is often a difference. Mm. And other experts can see it. And so how do we bring that knowledge into a courtroom? But it's still overall having expert witnesses come into court. The point of them is to translate science into something that's useful for a judge and jury. The good thing about it is that we aren't assuming in those instances that the judge just knows everything. And so if someone like me comes in and talks specifically about false memories, so I'm an expert on the issue of memory and when memories go wrong. So when we remember things that didn't actually happen. And also in the UK, something that I think because people watch too many courtroom drama, US-based classic issue that most lawyers have with shows, is that we don't have gavels in UK court. The idea that there's like order, and smash, smash, smash. That's not a thing that happens in the UK. Similarly, as an expert witness, I'm paid for / hired by the defense or the prosecution. But my role is to educate the court. And ultimately, I don't have any skin in the game. I don't care who wins or loses this case, right? This is my role as an expert witness, as an expert on memory, is to teach people in the courtroom how memory works and how the science applies to this case. So the idea of a hired gun doesn't really make sense in the UK because that's not what we're there for.
One of the things that I found most interesting about this was that you said that the confidence with which something is delivered is perhaps an indication of how accurate it is. And it seems a couple of the people that you interview in this agree with you and essentially say, I will only ever say this seems the most likely or this seems the most logical as opposed to this is 100% accurate.
In the episode where we talk about biases and spotting, so there's one catastrophic case that we talk about where basically a scientist goes in, gets it wrong, gets it catastrophically wrong. That leads to a huge investigation of all these wrongful convictions. And it's uncovered that this expert really wasn't much of an expert and just kind of made it up and misunderstood his own statistics. And I kind of don't want to give away which of the episodes it is.
No, that's fair enough.
The listener guessing which episode is a good expert, which one's a bad expert, which one's just changing. So it's very much, you know, experts, because sometimes experts come in and save the day, right? We bring in stuff that no one else has really considered and we can right a wrongful conviction. Sometimes, occasionally, experts also lead to the wrongful conviction. And in terms of confidence, what you hear in cases, and it's a big red flag for experts, what you hear in cases where there's a problem is often that an expert has been too confident and saying things like, this is definitely or certainly, or not using qualifiers. So if I give a statement as an expert witness, I would say things like, it's plausible that this is the result of a false memory. I would never say this is a false memory. I might say it's an impossible memory, but even then, I don't know if it's a false memory or a lie. But those qualifiers, that plausible, that possible, adding things like percentages or probabilities, that's what makes a better expert most of the time.
Yeah. And it really matters, and your series does drive that home, because people spend years and years of their life in prison in this country, and people get executed in other countries, and we later learn that they absolutely could not have done it. It's very, very interesting. Memory obviously plays a serious role. I just wanted to know what it was about memory that really appealed to you.
For me, memory is interesting because we all live in our own reality, and the way in which we perceive the world is already unique. So what I see watching or witnessing a crime, for example, is going to be different than what someone else notices or remembers about that same crime. And that can be things like perspective, so where you're standing in relation to it. So if you're closer or further away, if your eyesight is good or corrected, you forgot your glasses that day. There's a sort of easy stuff that's perceptually different. But then there's also how we remember things. And how we remember things is often in line with how we already understand the world. And things that we think are important at the time, which might not actually have relevance when it comes to a legal trial. And so what ends up happening is that in a court case, you have people discussing things that happened in the course of, sometimes we're talking seconds. Crimes, especially serious violent crimes, are incredibly short. It does not take a long time to do a lot of damage to somebody else. And so you're talking about a memory of an incident that's like maybe a minute long, max. And you're dissecting it for days or weeks. And that's just not the level of detail that we normally have. And so the question is, how do we understand when people disagree on things that they say they remember? So which of these parts of the memory are fact, basically, and which ones are not? And how do we make sure that when the police are interviewing suspects or witnesses, that they're not contaminating memories in the process by asking leading questions? And so one of the experts I talked to from within my field of psychology, I talk about interview techniques and interrogation and how that's changed dramatically over time as we've learned more about how we can contaminate memories by asking these leading or suggestive questions. And so now in the UK, certainly, we have evidence-based policing in sort of a world-leading way. It's one of the things we're really good at here in the UK. Good interviewing. And that's because of the collaboration between police and scientists, which is really exciting.
One of your episodes is about change, what we learn as we go along. We go back and we say, wow, what a mistake that was. How do we know what we believe to be true now isn't going to be proved wrong in 10, 20, 100 years' time?
We don't know. That's the truth of it. But what sounds, I think, inherently like we've made a mistake. So if a scientist goes into a courtroom and says, this is the state of the knowledge right now, and here's how it applies to this case. So here's what we understand about memory. It's plausible that this specific memory that you've given me to look at is the result of a false memory. And so maybe this didn't actually happen. Now, in that circumstance, for me, I'm relying on all the things that we know now. So I'm relying on current neuroscience. I'm relying on studies that have been done where people have been like including my own studies where I've implanted false memories in interview settings to see how they work and to see how we can contaminate memory intentionally so that we can then talk about it in courtrooms. But I'm relying on what we know now. And the point of science is that we know more over time. There's this a quote, I actually can't remember where it's from, but it's that we need to liberate knowledge from reality. And so that's the role of science, to liberate knowledge from reality. And as we do more science, hopefully we learn more. And so hopefully some of the things I say now are going to prove to be wrong in 100 years. Now, the problem is that if, let's say it's shorter than that, let's say within 10 years, which is in one of these cases, the science dramatically changes about how we should interpret a specific kind of crime scene. And the scientists are faced with this dilemma where they're going, 10 years ago or 20 years ago, I went into a courtroom and said, this person probably did this because of this evidence. And now I'm not so sure that this is actually indicative of the thing that I said it was. What do you do? And so the answer is, it's up to the experts to go back to the lawyers who hired you to say, by the way, the science has changed. You need to check whether that's relevant to, you know, whether that person might need an appeal, for example. Mm. And then it's up to the, sort of the law to decide whether that was actually the most important piece of evidence that might have wrongfully convicted someone, for example, and then review the case. But it's quite hard to do.
Yeah.
A decade later, trying to even find, or trying to even remember that you did this case, never mind who the lawyer was and then contacting them. So there's some issues with the system of self-correcting, but ultimately science itself is self-correcting, and so it should be changing. It doesn't mean we're doing it wrong. It's still the best thing we have right now. We should still be using it, even if for some things we're going to be wrong with stuff.
I mean, surely new science comes along, and of course then people are going to, if it's well publicized, people are going to jump on it, and they're going to say, this could disprove this. Obviously, there are lawyers, there are families, there are people in prison who think, my vindication. How do we make sure we don't get wrapped up in that? Because I was thinking about that whole recovered memory thing that happened and came sort of through like a train of, oh my God, this is a new way of looking at things. How do we make sure that we don't grasp onto something and just because it's new and it might hold the answer for you to not rigorously look at what it is?
Recovered memory is a good example because it wasn't based on science. It was based on ideas. So recovered memories was this idea that you bury memories, particularly of traumatic events, and that in the right circumstances, in therapeutic contexts, these memories can be unlocked. Now, of course, in therapy, people often remember things that they don't talk about or don't remember in other contexts. That is undisputed. What is disputed is this idea that your conscious mind hides things from you on purpose because it doesn't think you can handle them. And that's a concept that was proposed by Sigmund Freud, but it was never based on science. And so there is a field of people who are experts in psychology, so people who do psychoanalysis, who adhere to this idea, but it was never substantiated empirically, as in we didn't do sort of lab-based studies that showed that this is the thing that actually happens and that it exists. And so cognitive scientists, I don't think cognitive scientists have ever adhered to the idea of repressed memories. And so that's also where you get into who is an expert, which is something we talk about a lot in the series as well, because it's a good question. Like, who I consider an expert is someone who is a scientist or is doing research or basing their ideas on science. But not everyone has that as their benchmark, right? You might, and also for other fields, it's not the same. So an expert on law isn't a scientist. It's just in the kinds of things that I'm interested in. I wanted to be a scientist. So it always depends on what the question is you're trying to answer and what you accept as an expert or who you accept as an expert in that field. And so repressed memories, yes, it came around and it had a big impact on also wrongful convictions of people. But I would argue that that was never scientific. So I would never consider people who posit those ideas as experts and I have allowed them to testify in courtrooms. So that's where it gets tricky. But it's a really interesting question, I think. What we're trying to achieve with the series on Radio 4, so this Experts on Trial series, is to help people to understand how science enters courtrooms, what to be aware of if you are ever on a jury, for example, and also what not to be too skeptical of. So sometimes we go too far the other way, where suddenly we go, you know, well, no experts can tell us anything about you. And unless you're 100% sure about things, this is basically pointless, which is way too far towards skepticism. And so it's getting it right and making sure you understand some sort of core scientific literacy around this stuff.
I've got one more question for you. I just wondered what you think it is that drives the interest, the seemingly never-ending interest in true crime.
I think we love true crime because we like to try and understand why people do terrible things, which is something that I've sort of made a bit of a career out of. Is the point of that things. How do we understand our own propensity for sort of an inverted commas evil? And how do we also protect ourselves? So I think there is a sort of role-playing almost, where we're in our minds, we're thinking through these thought experiments of what's the worst thing that could happen to me or to someone I love, and then what would I do in that kind of circumstance? And I mean that from both sides. So if I were to accidentally hit someone with my car, for example, if I were to kill someone, if I were to make a bad decision and become a perpetrator, or if I were to become victimized. And so I think from both sides, we sort of quite enjoy thinking through what that would be like. And I think it's a good thing. I think it's good for us to try and empathize with people who do terrible things and to try and humanize them. But I think it's even better when we humanize them with science.
Tell me where people can find your other podcasts and whatever else you've got on the boil, Julia, which I'm sure is a huge amount.
I have a true crime podcast called Bad People. which went for 3 years on BBC Sounds. And then this series called Experts on Trial is obviously available on Radio 4.
Thank you so much for your time, Julia. This has been excellent.
All right, Mickey here with an advert for BetterHelp Therapy Online. You all right? Such a small question and sometimes such a big question too, eh? Now, regular listeners will know I am no stranger to depression, and while over time and with the help of some decent counselling and brilliant friends and family, I've established a toolkit to help when the constantly dripping tap of life gets a bit too much. That does not mean I am a stress-free human rainbow skipping through meadows. I mean, who is? We all carry around different stresses, big and small, and sometimes we can deal, and sometimes it's much harder to cope. Life, innit? Right now, I have a teenage puppy to deal with, and although I love her very, very much, she can be a lot. There, said it. And as quick a fix as it seemed to say, I'm fine, and push it all down into the big inside box and put that lid on. For me, that hasn't been a great long-term solution, in that if I don't get it off my chest, it will at some point come bubbling up, and it's never been one to pick its moments in a good way. I find talking means I can avoid it exploding out of me like a messy emotional volcano all over my nana's carpet. Also, during my various times in talk therapy, I discovered that saying something out loud or writing it down can make it seem much more manageable than allowing it to swirl around and grow ever bigger in my head. If you're thinking of starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. I've found knowing how to reach out is sometimes the toughest bit, but BetterHelp is entirely online. Boom. Which means it couldn't be easier. You just fill out a brief questionnaire to get matched with a registered therapist, then work your sessions around your schedule. With more than 1,000 therapists in the UK already, BetterHelp can provide access to mental health professionals with a wide variety of expertise in mental health. Standard Issue listeners get 10% off their first month at betterhelp.com/standard. That's betterhelp.com/standard.
I am joined by multidisciplinary artist, she's laughing, author of the new book, The Observable Universe, and also, spoiler alert, my friend, Heather McColden. Hi, Heather.
Hello.
We've just been having a very nice chat. It's been a while. You've gone back to the States. You're in London for a long time and you're now back in the States. We've already talked about how that's going for you, so maybe save the listener that. But what I would like to ask you about instead is the book. So can you tell me a little bit, first of all, about the book?
I was really hoping you were going to summarize it in your intro.
Hell no, I'm going to leave that for you to do.
Well, basically, it's a memoir composed in fragments that deals basically with three themes that are woven together. So one is my personal experience, essentially of my parents dying of AIDS and growing up alongside the internet. The other strand is basically about viruses and virality and HIV. And the other strand is essentially a history of the internet. Yeah, those are all bits that are chopped up and then kind of remixed together throughout the text. I guess like the other important element that I always forget to talk about is that the book is part detective story and is very influenced by Raymond Chandler and film noir. And so it's sort of like an exercise in genre in that respect. I don't know. I still don't know how to talk about this book, even though that's all I've been doing. Yeah.
It's described as a genre-bending book about grief in the internet age. And I remember talking to you about the book when you were still living in London, you were piecing it all together and it was doing your head in a bit. And I'm struggling a little bit to find a structure for this interview because there are tangents right there. I wondered if you could tell me, first of all, a little bit about the structure and why you wrote it in the way that you did.
As an aside, I guess you could describe it as a book of tangents.
I prefer genre bending.
Well, basically the structure comes from two sort of complementary elements. The first one is essentially that it's kind of no nice way of saying this, but my brain is a bit broken, so I can't really conceive of a linear structure. I have like short bursts of ideas or like momentary images, but I think like a normal person could construct a story around that. And that's just something I've not yet been able to do. So that's one reason for like these fragments. But what I thought was odd as I started to write this was that that structure is also very similar to living a life through browser tabs. The attention, not the attention span, but just how our brains function these days, which is, I mean, like right now, I think I have 12 tabs open on my browser, and I'm going back and forth between like face products I can't afford to like vacation destinations, to like a Wikipedia piece about the gambler's fallacy, a New York Times piece about why like walking in Los Angeles is cool. And I feel like in our contemporary era, like all of us are kind of doing that to some extent. And there's like an experience and sort of poetry that emerges from the collision of all these elements. I wanted the book to also reflect that. So it's sort of like a Venn diagram of my trauma and contemporary ways of being.
I don't know. I mean, maybe this was conscious, maybe it was not at all, and I'm just like reading too much into it. But I guess like a lot of it is about your memory of your parents and the things that you piece together about their lives. So is part of it sort of to do with the way we remember things as well, little fragments of bits and bobs and how they kind of like come into our brain and.
Totally. Like, I don't have a lot of material or things to go on from childhood. Like, I have memories of objects. I mean, that's probably the best way of putting it, like memories of objects or of photographs. And so it's sort of like this idea, which I do think, you know, anyone that's lost someone goes through. It's like, how do I piece together this human that used to take up essentially four dimensions in front of me? It just seems so impossible and wild that a person can just suddenly not be there. So, memory and piecing together memory is a way I think of conjuring the dead.
It's a deeply personal book, but then elements of it are also very impersonal and, you know, scientific. Was that a conscious decision, or is that just sort of how it came, it just fell together?
It's a bit of both. Like, it was happening naturally that I would sort of sit down and compose a section that was very personal or memory based. And there was always only so far I could push it. I had very clear and natural stopping points in terms of how far I could delve into my own sort of emotional history and put on the page. And, you know, in terms of basically looking for a counterpoint to that, like I do have like a very analytical and clinical side, so that would just show up, and like the next thing that I would write would be very grade school report style, like I am studying the oak tree. Like, you know, it would pop out like that. And some early readers were like, what the fuck are you doing? Like, I don't like that. That's like not a book you should write. And at some points, it was very clear. It was like I could be writing an airport schmaltzy, sad tale of this orphan girl and, you know, kind of go on autopilot and just crank something out. Obviously, I would never do that. And I'm not interested in doing that. And it's not necessarily that people wanted me to go in that direction. They were just like very confused. Like, why is this like atonal thing happening in the middle of a reverie? But I think I was trying to create music essentially in the text of like, well, that's why the emotional bits hit so hard, because the tonal register is completely different.
I think it's really interesting because I think to some people, obviously, the themes that you're talking about will not necessarily seem like natural bedfellows, if you will. Like they, it won't necessarily make huge amounts of sense to people to kind of put all of these topics in together. But I guess that you're developing the strand about the internet and connectivity alongside that of your grief and what happened to you, because you came to make some discoveries about your parents, right, via the internet, right?
I mean, the internet is like a really ghostly place to begin with. And when we're exploring it, we're often exploring like levels of consciousness within ourselves. So I think like that's, there is something, it's not that it's connected to death, but it's connected to things that are lost and are no longer like tangible. So that's like sort of one connection. But the other reason the book is about the internet is because I feel like, you know, I was starting to like come of age when all of a sudden, here's this tool that you have access to all information, basically that's ever existed, and all culture that you could want. You can talk to people at any time of day, anywhere in the world. And I feel like there's a generation of people that got really fucked up by that. So to me, that's like another undercurrent of grief and why it's in the book. It's like why I consume information and share information the way that I do. It's like my parents died, then I had this machine that was like, let me teach you about the world. What do you want to know about the world? And, you know, it emerges that way. To me, it is related. And I hope I explain why it's related in the book at some points, like in a clear way.
In what way do you think that it has sort of fucked us up?
I mean, the biggest thing is that the internet has made time a fluid substance. There is no time on the internet. And I don't know what grief is if there's no past, present, or future. If we're just living in a perpetual now, and my now is that my heart hurts so much I can't breathe, what is the life in that? But yeah, I think just in terms of like the generational trauma, I don't know that our young brains were ready for that ginormous download of welcome to every corner of the earth at once. I mean, now it's different. Like it's different from kids that are just born into like, you know, the technology that we now have. But when you experienced a before, and then you're 17, you discover music. You can like literally put your art out there immediately, or you can buy drugs or like learn how to build a bomb. Just things that are so wild that no one ever contemplated before happening to just a younger brain that is active, but not grounded in reality yet. Yeah.
We've created a monster and we absolutely don't know what to fucking do with it.
Like, right.
It's,
yeah.
There's loads of things that are great about it, but the technology moves so quickly that actually we've created something that the human brain can't possibly keep up with. So then what happens to it? I guess it runs away, right? Without us.
Totally. I mean, I think too, it's funny because it's, I don't know when the last time we created something that like the human brain didn't have the ability to fully conceive. You know, I think like even sending people into space, we're like, well, I don't know, we understand 30% of what could happen, but it wasn't 100% of this is unknown. And I think the way, especially with the AI motion generators, and I mean, even ChatGPT, there's going to be a point where it's like 100%, we don't know what this is anymore. That's going to be a fun time.
So, Heather, what have you got coming up next? Because you work across a variety of different arts. Are you focusing on the writing for now, or are you going to be kind of like looking at other things?
I mean, I'm definitely thinking about the next book, and I've like collected a bunch of notes and have, you know, chunks of material that at some point I'm going to sew together. And the subject is time.
Nice and easy, lovely, really simple follow-up.
Totally. Nothing complicated there. And some friends in San Francisco have asked me to direct a dance film for them.
Oh,
so
wow.
I will be doing that in May. And it will be a very tiny film, but it's going to be shot on a stone fruit farm that's 100 years old and has been owned by like the same Japanese family since its inception. So yeah, I'm pretty excited about that.
Amazing. Heather, The Observable Universe is available to buy now, published by Fitzcarraldo Editions in the UK. Where can we follow you on the socials if we would wish to do so? I already do, but if the listener would like to find out more about what you're up to.
Yeah, I'm only on Instagram at Les Jeunes Electriques. Can you just spell it in the show notes, or do you need me to like orally?
No, you're gonna have to. There'll be a picture of you on our Instagram at some point, so we will tag you in that. If you don't want to look up how to spell that, then you'll be able to find Heather through Standard Issues Instagram in the very near future. Heather, it's an amazing book. I really do think it is a very, very beautifully written book. So congratulations. You don't need me to say that to you, but congratulations, and thank you so much for chatting to me about it.
It's a real pleasure. It's actually like a real honor to be on this podcast. So thank you. Thank you for making the time.
Welcome to Rated or Dated. Mickey, can you tell me what Wolfgang Petersen did after Death Boot, please? Well, yeah. This week, we watched 1984's much-loved fantasy quest, The Neverending Story. Much-loved? Or mercifully short? You decide. Rated? Or dated? Loosely based on the 1979 best-selling German novel of the same name, written by a man called, I shit you not, Michael End. Now, End wasn't too happy with director and co-screenwriter Wolfgang Petersen's final adaptation. And when his demands that filming be halted or the title be changed were ignored, he sued. He lost. Or did he? More on that in a bit. Da da da! Drama! As Hannah pointed out, Wolfgang Petersen's project just before The Neverending Story, it is worth noting, was Das Boot. Pigeonhole at your peril, people. And while no means the Oscar botherer of its predecessor, Neverending Story performed pretty well at the box office, grossing $100 million worldwide from a budget of around $25 to $27 million. Reviews were mixed, with some critics praising its visual effects and others pointing out that Falco the Dragon looked like an impractical bath mat. That was not a compliment, by the way. The film took home a handful of German film awards and bagged a Saturn Award for young Noah Hathaway's performance as Atreyu. Indeed, it thrusts its two young male stars, Hathaway and... Hello?
Sorry, I'm just open-mouthed at that.
Oh, right.
Literally, just open-mouthed that kid won an award for shouting. Moving on.
We're not moving on. We're staying with him because it thrusts its two young male stars, Hathaway and Barrett Oliver as Bastion, into teen heartthrob status. And so I had a little nose, just was curious, you know, as to what they look like these days at 52 and 50 respectively. And, like, I don't want to be a bitch, but there is something to be said about not peaking as a teenager. It also stars the voice of Skeletor, or Alan Oppenheimer, as he probably prefers to be called in real life, on vocal duties for the impractical Basmat, Gmork the Angry Wolf, and Rockwiter. He boldly opts to use exactly the same voice for all of them. Perhaps a standout for me, however, is the 80s synth-pop banger of a theme tune from Lamal called Neverending Story, but with different spacing, for reasons, I don't know why. And Hannah, I do think it's important to note that rhymes that keep their secrets will unfold behind the clouds, and there upon a rainbow is the answer to a never-ending story. Peace out. The original German version of the film didn't get this theme song, and surely that makes the whole thing 60% less good. And I don't think it has those margins to play with. No! But Hannah, as we know, nostalgia is one hell of a drug. And End, remember him, is about to get his own way. Kind of. 40 years on from losing his lawsuit and just 29 years after his death, Michael End Productions and Seesaw Films are bringing the world of Fantasia back to cinemas via a series of live-action films. Watch this space, or don't, I'm not your real mum. Had you seen The Neverending Story before?
I had not, and I'd like to take this opportunity to thank my parents publicly for that.
I hadn't seen it either. I thought I must have done, but I knew about the dragon. I'd seen the dragon. I've seen him in a lot of memes.
I think he must have been in the Lamal video, which I no doubt would have seen. I think the bits that look familiar will have come from that.
Yeah,
maybe not.
I agree. No, I feel like that's the same for me. Let's have a look at the plot. 10-year-old Bastian Bux' mum has just died and he's getting mad bullied at school. But what's worse is he's been found doodling unicorns in his maths book. This being the 1980s, his dad tells him to stop living in a fantasy world and face up to his problems. Just to reiterate, he's 10 and his mum just died. What a pussy. Anyway, three of his problems chase him down the street and chuck him in a skip. To avoid it immediately happening again, he takes shelter in a bookshop, where the owner is reading a book he deems not safe for Bastian. Well, the new and improved big bad Bastian isn't deterred, so he nicks it and sneaks into the school attic to read it. You know, the school attic. Looks like the attic of a haunted mansion. There's a key marked attic on the wall next to the door to it. The school attic. Totally a thing. The book is, of course, the never-ending story, and Bastian soon finds himself reading about Fantasia, a weird old place of oddball characters and obvious metaphors. What's that? The Sea of Possibilities? Fantasia, though, is falling apart thanks to malevolent force, the Nothing, who is aided by an angry wolf called Gamorg. The Empress of Fantasia has called on a young warrior hero, Atreyu, to adventure forth to find out how to save the land. Atreyu boldly travels through the swamps of sadness, losing his best equine mate on the way, encountering an unhelpful turtle, a slightly creepy-looked dragon, a couple of gnomes, and Bastian in a mirror.
Slightly?
He keeps winking, Hannah. I don't like it. Turns out the Empress needs a new name to save Fantasia. Bum, says Bastian. If I were there, I'd name her after my mum. She had a wonderful name, but I'm only the reader. By now, Fantasia is literally in chunks, but Atreyu makes it back to the Empress, who tells him only Bastian can save them by calling out her new name. After a bit of faffing because he doesn't really believe it's happening, Bastian calls out Moonchild, which means his mum was called Moonchild.
That won't be a thing. Unless she's like Frank Zappa's kid.
Why not use his grandma all in Phoenix? What the fuck? Anyway, Fantasia saved, horse back to life, etc, etc. Bastian boards his bath mat and chases down the bullies. Hurrah! First things first, Hannah, you sent me a text asking whether he fucked the luck dragon. Explain yourself.
Did you not find that really, really odd and a bit seedy and a bit, oh, I've woken up in the arms of this person who's now winking at me and saying things in a really quite creepy voice? It was just, no, I think the luck dragon might, I don't know. Yeah.
The Luck Dragon, I agree, Falcor is creepy, man. Really, he keeps like a really slow wink. And that might just be the puppet, but it's really weird. Like
his first lines are, I like children. Said in like a crazy, sinister voice. And then he rubs his ear and he goes, I like it. It's just, the whole thing is seedy.
And I did not like it.
Did you think it was a good looking dragon, though?
No, I found the whole thing to just be awful. I found him to be terrible.
No.
You did spot the Deadwood Big Bad, though, right?
I did, yes. Gerald McRaney was in
George
there.
George Hurst.
Yeah, being a lot nicer than he is in Deadwood, even though he was saying, pull yourself together, kid.
Your mum's gone. We've got a crack on. Now, come on. So 1980s. Yeah. So 1980s. Like, then the kid goes missing for like hours, days,
a whole night.
One knows.
Yeah,
it's quite silly.
Obviously I'm an adult now and I didn't see this as a child, so I don't have any sentimental thing, but nothing about it is good. The effects are shit, the plot is shit, the puppetry is shit, the acting, the Bastian kid, he's good. I don't know why they didn't get him to play two roles, to be honest, because he's maybe because of like laws that you can't work for that many hours. Because the other kid, the Atreyu kid, is terrible. He just shouts all his lines. He is, I think, not a good actor at all. It's really poorly dubbed at the start.
Yeah.
The sound quality at one point, it felt like I was listening to it through a glass pressed up to my neighbour's wall at one point.
Yeah, it goes in and out, doesn't it? It's quite strange.
And it makes no sense. Like, huge chunks of it. He loses his horse in the Swamp of Sadness,
because apparently a horse can have an existential crisis.
I mean, I've seen them with a carrier bag, that's true.
But then he sits in the swamp of sadness, sobbing. Nothing happens to him.
Because his horse just died. He's quite rightly upset about this.
But he should sink into the swamp of sadness because he's totally sad.
But that's when creepy Bathmat arrives and saves him. Creepy Bathmat, waits till he's on his own.
Yeah. Oh, you talk in your sleep. Oh.
Yeah, waits till he's on his own, then swoops in and scoops him up from the swamp. Oh, little boy needed rescuing.
And then says, I was next to you when you were really vulnerable, talking in your sleep. Really slow wink.
The death of Artax the horse in the swamps of sadness genuinely made me a little bit sad, though. I don't like to see an animal die.
Well, I suppose he doesn't die, does he? I actually did find one bit in this actually quite touching. Unexpectedly touching.
Yeah. Was it when they threw him in a skip?
No, it's when the rock says, these look like good strong hands and I couldn't save them. I actually thought that was quite well written and quite touching.
Yeah, that is. But also, I do have a question about Rockbiter, though. Is he a cannibal? Why? He's just eating rocks.
Yeah, he's eating rocks. Yeah. I am a rock and I bite rocks. Yeah.
It's like the murder fish in my house. Very similar, but with hands.
I do want to say that when he goes through the swamp of sadness and he's really muddy, right? Hold that image in your head, right? I fell over on Exmoor yesterday. That kid had nothing on me. Nothing. When I came back down, I met a couple and I said, oh, it's very slippy up there. And the guy said to me, yeah, looks it. No, he's just absolutely caked in mud. So then I was like, I'm just going to get in my car and drive 7 hours home.
Did you do that thing where you slipped and then every time you tried to stand up, you slipped more until you were just covered?
I didn't, no. But I did shout really loudly and profusely swear. And then I looked around and there was absolutely nobody there. And I felt really, really relieved that nobody was going to come over. And then I wasn't going to have to pretend that it didn't hurt. You know, when you fall over and you're embarrassed, you have to pretend that it didn't hurt. So I got to sit there and let all of that mud and goo soak into my trousers and feel a bit sorry for myself for
incredible
30 seconds and then stand up.
I was once running for a tram in Manchester and the doors were just closing. And so I leapt to get on the tram and I caught my foot on the doorway and basically just sort of supermanned it right across the tram and crashed into the other side. I mean, as luck would have it, a woman had gone out and bought a duvet and I crash landed into her big bag of duvet, which was very useful. And the tram was silent and everyone stared at me until I started laughing. And then they felt it was fine to laugh at the woman who just like flown through the door and crashed into
a
duvet.
You fell into a bag of duvets?
I fell into a bag of duvets.
That's almost as great as like when people go through that. Oh no, there's two people carrying a massive pane of glass. We have to avoid that. You fell into a bag of duvets.
I feel like I lived a charmed life for those 30 seconds, Hannah. The luck dragon was watching down on me.
Perhaps there was a luck dragon in there, not a duvet. Tell me what you made of how it looks, because I thought it just... There's a bit where I absolutely roared laughing when they first arrive at the ivory tower. And one of them, possibly the bat, says, it's beautiful. I did a proper lols. Because, listener, it is not beautiful.
It's pretty shonky, isn't it? And bear in mind, unlike you and Jen, who obviously not here for this one, and, you know, God bless her, she's absolutely looked dragoned out on that one, hasn't she? But I am a big fan of Labyrinth, The Princess Bride, all of these kind of films, which made it a bit weird that I hadn't seen it. I think my sister was a massive fan of Neverending Story. But, yeah, and they do sort of look very dated in the effects, but I still love them. I still think they look brilliant. There's still that nostalgia, whereas this just looks shit. Looks terrible.
Is the problem, do you think, that it is German and we're just used to things, American-looking things, and American sensibility things, and this is actually a German sensibility thing, and therefore we just haven't quite got into it properly.
Maybe. And it's because it's not a budget thing. It had like a $25 million budget, which in 1984 must have been worth about £3 trillion. I don't know. I'm not an economist, but like worth more. So it's not a tiny budget for a film.
No, and it's Wolfgang Petersen, and it was edited by Steven Spielberg.
What happened? I don't understand. It's not even cute. Like, the dragon's not cute. He's creepy. Rockbite is quite cute. But and that's it. The other characters, they're just not in it. They're literally just not in it. It's two boys and a bath mat. That is the story.
Yeah. And the woman from A Fish Called Wanda with the dogs.
Is she the gnome?
She's the old lady.
The old lady gnome.
And then the one that looks like he's Mark Gatiss in costume, the old man in it. You could have gone loads more out of them, because that was actually like a reasonably good dynamic, the two of them. They could have stayed in it longer. You know, he's a bit madcap. They argue all the time. I mean, I'm not saying it's a dynamic that I would necessarily want to watch more of, but there could have been more of that and it would have been better. Everybody's in it. How are you supposed to care about anyone? And then when you get to the end, there's this sort of, you know, Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom, you've got to go through the gates thing at the end, both of which are like, seem to be
how
like...
How dare you bring Indiana Jones into this Hammond movie?
No, but that's my point. I mean, they both got through so quickly. And at the end, the thing, in a real Sinbad style, the thing that's supposed to say something profound to him says, whoever has control has the power. I mean, what? Of course they do. They have control. How has he had to go through this? How has he had to look like me on Dartmoor, right? to get to someone saying the most ridiculous platitude.
Why are the oracles always played by Judith Butler? I don't understand.
Yeah.
Yeah, I agree with you about the gnomes. They've got a kind of Billy Crystal, Carol Kane in the Princess Bride dynamic.
Yes. Yeah.
And they do not make the most of that whatsoever.
No. And it's also interesting that she lives in an ivory tower. And I don't know when the words ivory tower became a bad thing, but the words ivory tower is a bad thing, isn't it?
Maybe it was like the beginning of this film that did it, Hannah. They were just like, oh, it's terrible.
But like, living in an ivory tower is something that you're like, criticize people. You know, the idea is that, oh, you know what living in an ivory tower is.
Hannah,
the idea that she lives in an ivory tower is a bit weird.
Agreed. I did read something that actually struck a chord with me, because we in all fairness, this is for kids. It is a kids film. And I read an essay, an overlong essay, so listeners, like, credit to me for putting myself through that for you. I'd already watched
hero.
This film, and then I know, thank you, I am a hero. And it said that it was about grief, and it's a way of explaining grief to kids. Now, it very much leans on the debunked theory of grief going in various stages. But it makes sense that this kid is being chased by the nothing. His world is falling apart. He's got to go through sadness, despair, loss, anger, and disbelief, like denial, before he can accept what's happened and kind of carry on with his life.
Yeah, interesting. But just because the theory behind it is good doesn't make it a good film. It could still have been about all those things and just not been terrible.
Would you be prepared to watch it again with that in mind?
No. No.
I asked the question knowing what the answer was going to be there.
Would you?
Oh, fuck off. No, absolutely not.
You read the essay, which is more than I did. Yeah, I just think it's past its prime would be an understatement.
Yeah.
I don't even know if it had a prime.
The years have not been kind to it.
No.
But was the production kind to it in the first place?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, it's just, I find the whole thing really odd that it's Wolfgang Petersen. I mean, what the hell? Maybe some people shouldn't make children's films.
I wouldn't have put money on the maker of Das Boot going on to make a kid's film, if I'm honest with you. I wouldn't have guessed that. Listeners, if any of you are proper diehard Never Ending Story fans, because they exist, they absolutely still exist, they walk among us, please do at us and tell us what you loved about it. The guy who played Atreyu, Noah Hathaway, award-winning Noah Hathaway, went on to become a tattoo artist, and apparently one of the ones he does most is the amulet that Atreyu wears. Like,
right.
People come and want that tattooed on their body, Hannah.
I mean, yeah, there's no accounting for taste, is there?
Let's have a look at people who've won X Factor and indeed the government. No accounting for taste whatsoever. One last question for you, Hannah. It's a biggie. I'm excited to know what you're going to say. It could go either way. Never-ending story, rated or dated?
Yeah, I mean, definitely, categorically, Absolutely, 100% dated.
Yeah, it's nice to have a really definitive answer, isn't it? Dated. Yeah. What are we watching next?
So, next is Jen's pick. She's not here, so I'm going to speak on her behalf, but not sadly pick on her behalf. We're watching 1989's Teen Witch. Never heard of it. More okay. Kid stuff, I'm guessing.
Yeah,
I think so. Probably more shonky special effects.
Yeah, well, 1989, definitely.
Moonchild!
Standard issue for all women.